The aim of Black Mental Matters is to tell experiences with honesty. Therefore, some discussions may trigger an adverse reaction. If a discussion is beginning to upset you, we advise that you please stop listening and talk to your support team.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode 33 of Black Mental Matters. How you doing? I'm Vince the Voice, myself, along with Makiba Reed Johnson. We work to eradicate, to just get rid of that stigma as it relates to mental health in the Black community. We hope and pray that everything is okay for you and yours during this COVID-19 lockdown. And we want to acknowledge at this time that there's a group of us out here who are really, really facing some challenges. I'm talking about our friends and family in the LGBTQ+ community. I mean, think about it. Some are in various processes of gender identity or transitioning, now experiencing isolation, could be depression. Suicide has been greatly increased, especially as it relates to the young people there. You know, they went away to college and that gave them some resources, social networks, and a safe place to explore their sexuality and gender identities. And now they're back home with family who may not be quite so understanding. So on this program, we brought in an expert, Mr. David J. Johns, a very accomplished man. You want to hear what he has to say. So we thank you so much for tuning in. Black Mental Matters, it starts right now. Black Mental Matters, Vince the Voice and Makiba Reed Johnson. And Makiba, today we have the honor of having none other than, I mean, this man from the first executive director of the White House Initiative on Educational Excellence for African Americans to now the executive director of the National Black Justice Coalition, Mr. David J. Johns with us. How you doing, David?
Yes, welcome, David.
Thank you, I appreciate that.
Wow, out of,
welcome.
Yes, you're in Washington, D.C., correct, Dave?
Our office is headquartered in D.C., but in addition to being the ED, really having the pleasure of quarterbacking the team at NBJC, I'm also completing a PhD at Columbia. So I'm actually sheltered in place in New York at present.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness. So you've got a lot going on right now.
To say the least.
David, oh, my gosh.
Well, David, we're just so honored. Your career, yeah. I mean, reading and learning about you, man, you focused on improving life outcomes and opportunities, particularly for the Black community, and even more particularly, you know, with the NBJC, the Empowerment of Black, Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender, and Queer People. So can I just ask, what got you started on this journey?
So a lot of, it's interesting. There's a lot of challenges that are going on social media, and I participated this morning in the Baby Face Challenge, and I posted a picture of me on someone's stage with a trophy and a crown on my head.
Okay.
Reminding folks that I have been, and essentially one of the questions that the person is asking is, you know, who placed that crown on the top of your head? And I responded, you know, Grace, that all of this has been purposed. And I share that because I do think it's relevant that I've always been an advocate for what my grandfather, who recently passed, the Baptist preacher, would refer to as the least of these. Mm. So whether that meant that I was getting in trouble as a elementary school student for advocating for more time for my classmates that had hidden disabilities, or founding an organization while a senior at Columbia University to respond to the convergence of ignorance and privilege, taking a pay cut from teaching kindergarten because the inequities that I saw in my classroom at my school, many people told me would be solved by policymakers in D.C. So I took a pay cut from teaching to become a fellow in D.C. to test that theory. And so everything that has happened to date, and I believe that even about the current moment that we're in as a global community, for me has been ordained. And a lot of it is leveraging the privilege that I have inherited and that I've worked for to provide access to better opportunities for other folks that are not as privileged as I am.
Wow.
Excellent.
And so, you know, this program, we again, focus on mental matters and mm-hmm. how things, you know, so McKeeb and I were talking even prior to talking to you, that the scenarios that are going on in households right now with, mm-hmm. you know, perhaps family members who are LGBTQ and that dynamic that could be going on, negative dynamic that could be going on. And so we want to try to help some of our folks out there make it through this time and just make it a better outcome. So where do we begin, Makeba? Go ahead. You fire away.
Oh, yeah. First of all, David, I'm so excited to have you on board for this podcast because, you know, we brought up something that we don't speak about in our community, is the discrimination against LGBT folk within the Black community and the impact of that on mental health. 40% of LGBTQIA plus Black youth feel depressed most or all of the time, and 60% of youth have reported being so sad or hopeless that they stop doing their usual activities. And Black, queer, gay, lesbian, trans children are four times more likely to attempt suicide. So this is why I wanted you to kind of just talk about, you know, what this looks like in our community, because what's so different is that when we're talking about discrimination, and I'm trying to stay away from, you know, the terminology, David, of homophobia, transphobia, biphobia, because that implicates fear. Right. Well, yeah, because it implicates fear, and it's really what I've seen, especially with, right, it's ignorance. It's discrimination, it's hatred, and it's a violation of civil and human rights.
Mm. Yeah, most definitely. So let me try to make a couple of points. I appreciate you providing me with this entree into this. Many of the stats that you referenced were included in a report that the National Black Justice Coalition was honored to contribute to, called Ring the Alarm, the Crisis Amongst Black Youth and Suicide, and it was submitted to Congress via the Congressional Black Caucus. Mm-hmm. There was an emergency task force that was established by Congresswoman Bonnie Watson Coleman out of Jersey to respond to the escalation mm-hmm. in stats, where we saw many people that work with young people, not just Black LGBTQ, but Black youth generally. I want to make clear that I'm starting by just talking about Black folks generally, mm-hmm. as inclusively as possible. What we saw is that mm-hmm. Over the last 20 years, the rate of suicide, both attempts and completion, have been decreasing for all groups of young people, with the exception of Black kids. Mm. Over the last 20 years, the exact opposite has been true. The rates of suicide have doubled for Black kids. And what we know, what I know, what NDJC knows, is that when Black America generally catches a cold, Black LGBTQIA plus, and I use the term same gender loving, in part because gay is often used as a white male political identifier.
Yes.
That's important, and I'll come back to this, because many of the statistics that you referenced that also included a GLSEN report that we contributed to only account for the Black kids that will identify as LGBTQIA. There are many Black kids, just like there are many Black adults and many people more generally, that engage in queer, sexual, intimate, romantic relationships and behaviors, but will never identify as members of that community. Why is that? That is because Black people by and large live with other Black people. We are disproportionately concentrated in the South. We live in states mm-hmm. where it is legal to discriminate against individuals based on actual or perceived sexual identity, gender orientation, or expression. And so the world will have us believing, in part because of how white privilege works and how narratives are told via Hollywood, the gay people, mostly white people, but gay people get to come out to their family, move to a gay neighborhood like Hollywood, California, or Boys Town, Chicago, or Chelsea, New York, get to join a gay civil society, a Stonewall group, and then derive other forms of power from their gay identity. Mm-hmm. That's just not true for Black people. It is most often the case that coming out, our term that I like to use, inviting in, because in part we don't owe anybody anything. And there's a way that coming out does this psychological thing of giving heterosexual people this power and waiting for the moment when queer people revealed to them when they knew that they were different. We can come back to that later. But my point here is that we live with other Black people in spaces where we don't have the privilege of identifying publicly with members of the LGBTQIA community. All of that matters now because the states in the South, the states where we live, right? Think about what's happening in Georgia and in Florida, in relationship to this global pandemic. In those states, Black people are economically depressed. It has everything to do with the vestiges of transatlantic enslavement, white supremacy, and anti-Blackness. And when Black people are challenged economically, politically, or socially, those who have the additional gifts and burdens that come with other marginalized identities face more challenges. And so I'll just pause this here just by saying that I am most worried about Black queer people who are most burdened and least likely to have the kinds of resources that are needed to deal with those burdens, especially as it relates to mental health. For kids who are or who are perceived to be queer, sometimes their homes are not safe spaces. And so we should all be mindful of the fact that there are some kids for whom school, in spite of what we know generally they are, they can be terrifying spaces, but they can also be safe. Yes. And so I worry very much about their psychological and mental well-being as well as that of the adults who are charged with supporting their learning and development and growth.
Wow.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was thinking about the number of students and the data on the college students that are now home that have, you know, been on campuses or in schools where, you know, there weren't gender appropriate facilities on campus, and that there is a link to that information with it being those children or those students are 45% more likely to try to take their own lives because they didn't have that affirmation on the campus. And David, if you could talk to, from this platform, parents who are at home that, you know, don't have the language, don't have the education, but they've got the child.
Yes.
And the child is there, and the child is trying to communicate who they are and need that affirmation and that support. How would you guide that parent or that guardian into creating that space for that student or that child?
Yeah, I'd say three things. One is that there are resources to support everyone in developing the language and the competence to be more compassionate. And so I would encourage everybody to visit nbjc.org. We have a LGBTQIA SGL terminology guide that you can literally download, and it'll tell you the terms to avoid and why, and the terms to use to be able to have these conversations and to be able to make space for people in the way that they've always shown up and that we're just now being able to talk about. The second thing is that I would encourage everyone to remember that so much of this is about acknowledging that that which many of us take for granted is socially constructed, right? Like what it means for somebody to be Black or a woman or queer. And I should be clear that I don't want to assume that everybody knows what I mean by the term queer, but I really mean that to be anything that's not white or heterosexual or otherwise the term that we use in the academy is hegemonic, that referring those people in power, right? Those things are, they've been created, right? Like sexual identity, as we know it, many people take it for granted in this country in particular, but it's a relatively recent invention. And so I say that to try and shift us away from the place where we generally start these conversations, which is some people standing in judgment with their arms folded, not wanting to be uncomfortable because learning and adopting new language requires us to be uncomfortable and to accept that we all have something about us that we otherwise find uncomfortable talking about in public because of the way that stigma works and because of the way that the social constructions have played out over time. And so finding a way to see people as people, especially if you birth those people, is incredibly important for me, right? The last point I'll make here before moving on to my third and final response to this question is a reminder of what Asa Hilliard said, which is that I've never met a child, a particular Black child, who is not a genius. I, David Johns, would add that I've never met a Black child who has to be born. And so I will acknowledge that it's difficult, but I would also say that we have the responsibility of doing this work. I say that educators in particular who accept the responsibility of doing God's work and showing other spaces that babies are required to move through. And I say that the parents who also have the responsibility of creating safe spaces for their children to learn and develop with it so that they can go into the world and deal with the things that we all invariably are challenged with. The last thing I will say is that it's important for people to find support. And so much of the work that we do as an organization, we have, we do a lot of cultural competence work. We do a lot of that work with historically Black colleges and universities, as well as with pre-K through 12 school systems and schools. And so much of what we try and do in those spaces is remind everyone of the importance of listening to the baby. Too often, adults engage in conversations with young people and with other people, not acknowledging that they, those young people, those babies, those children in your households are experts in their own experiences. They know best what they need and how we can support them as they learn and grow. And too often what I have seen is that adults don't listen to have conversations where we learn from young people. We listen to tell them what we've done so that their lives are better than they otherwise have to be. We listen to tell them what we're doing to try and shield them from other stuff that they're not aware of. And so much of what we try and do through this thing called Thriving Summits, it's a series that I pioneered in the White House while still working for my president, Barack Hussein Obama, and his fabulous wife, Michelle Yvonne Robinson Obama, but is literally putting young people and their needs at the center.
Wow. This is Black Mental Matters, and we're talking today with David J. Johns. He's the executive director of the National Black Justice Coalition, civil rights organization dedicated to the empowerment of Black, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people, including people living with AIDS, HIV. And I mean, just as you can hear, just so powerful, David. And again, Makeba talked about in those households, you know, what we want to be able to do is give our audience some guidance, I guess, and you know, as to how those relationships can be better, because as we've noted, when if ever the ultimate happens where someone takes themselves out because of whatever oppression they're receiving, then all these terms and labels and things go away. We want to you know, we just want that person back again. And so David, the information you're laying on us, man, is just awesome, and I applaud you for the work that you're doing, no doubt.
Yeah,
I appreciate that. If I could respond to something you just said, yes, we should all be mindful that the loss of life is most severe. I'm like having a visceral body reaction as I talk through this. And I think most often about Nigel Shelby, who is he would have been 60 on February 1st. But he was a 15-year-old Black boy when he died by suicide in Huntsville, Alabama, in part because he was bullied for being Black and gay in a part of the country where it is still not acceptable to be either Black or gay, let alone both at the same time. And so we have an obligation to do more for babies like Nigel, again, who didn't ask to be born and who struggle with our own lack of responsibility and responsiveness. But I also want to be clear that there are so many babies who die a literal death because they are told that they are not worthy, not deserving of love, or otherwise find validation showing up exactly as they are in the spaces that they're forced to move through. And so that shows up, and this has everything to do with mental health. The visceral response people have where they shrink, or they hide parts of who they are. Are they trade relationships with people and otherwise do this a psychological dance where they are not able to simply be? I want to be clear. I think white supremacy wins when Black folks are not simply able to be self-actualized, and whatever that means to us. Audre Lorde talked about that in other ways as well. But I'm trying to make the point that that there are other forms of death that we should be mindful of that Black LGBTQ people are much more inclined to experience because Black people that enjoy and practice heterosexual privilege don't make space for.
Absolutely, absolutely. David, can you also talk to us about the importance of pronouns?
Yes.
And also the importance of when you have a transgender child, the importance of honoring those pronouns and also honoring that child or that person's new chosen name and allowing that dead name to remain dead.
Mm. Yeah. So I want to separate two things. I'll start with the conversation about trans identity, and then we'll have a separate but related conversation about pronouns. And I want to do that because there's a way that the two get conflated. And I'll come back to why that's problematic when we talk about Black folks. So I want to be clear that and there was a one of my babies, Justin Calhoun, actually giving testimony before Congress connected to the Black youth mental health report that I mentioned, talked about and gave an analogy about the trauma that's inflicted upon trans people when they're misgendered. And he talked about, imagine that you as a Black person, and he was talking to Black women, congressional representatives at the time, Sheila Jackson Lee and Barbara Watson Coleman. He said, imagine doing work your entire life to find comfort in your identity as a Black woman. Something that Malcolm X said long time ago is the most disrespected mm-hmm. thing to be in our country still today. And in spite of you doing all of the work to find comfort in that, every time you show up in some places, people refer to you as anything other than a Black woman, mm-hmm. right? I want to be clear that the identity, actually, let me back up and make a point. I want all of us to appreciate that we don't know as much, or we don't talk as much, rather, I should say that, in schools about the relationship between sex and gender. And this is important because there are too many people that don't understand that transgender mm-hmm. is the opposite of cisgender. And a mm-hmm. cisgender is a privileging that happens when a doctor assigns mm-hmm. a gender that aligns with your identity, right? And for the vast majority of people, you were born with either a penis or a vagina and related biological functions that many people assume and many people take for granted are often true when one is born with those genitalia. But there are a number of people for whom that is not true. There's a small group of people that are born and doctors are not able to identify their genitalia. And there's even smaller group of people who are born with signs of both. Those people are called mm-hmm. intersex. And there are also people who are assigned a particular gender for a number of reasons. And their identity, the way that they show up in the world, the way that they see themselves when they look in the mirror, the way that they go to bed at night, is different and is inconsistent with the decision that a doctor made. Those people are transgender. There is a spectrum, just like there is a spectrum in terms of what it means to be Black or to be a woman or to be a Black woman. There is a spectrum with regard to what it means to be transgender. For example, there are some people that will refer to themselves as a transgender man or a transgender woman. And there are some people that will refer to themselves as a woman or as a man, right? And there are similar parallels for Black people. The thing that I would implore everyone to appreciate is that people should be respected for how they show up in the world. Too often when it comes to Black trans folks, the position that people adopt is, I don't care and I don't want to respect how you show up in the world. What I'm going to privilege beyond and above all that is what a doctor determined and what somebody put on your birth certificate years ago. And to be clear, it's just flagrantly disrespectful. Mm-hmm. It's also problematic because when we think about the fact that Black trans women, more than any other group of LGBTQIA mm-hmm. people, are disproportionately murdered, many of their murders remain unsolved because of this practice of dead naming, the term that you, Makiba, mentioned, which is a lack of recognition of one's identity. And there's lots of efforts that are happening across the country and that we're engaged in to change both policy and practice to respond to that. To shift a little bit to the broader question about pronouns, I want to be clear that there is a movement that is led primarily by progressive white LGBTQ organizations and advocates to remind people about what I've referenced earlier with regard to social constructions, particularly around identities. And a way to do that is to name pronouns. And so, for example, The way that this typically happens is that I would have started this conversation with you all by reiterating that my name is David Johns and my pronouns are he, him, his. And what that would do, for example, is if, for example, I was non-binary or my pronouns were, my name was David, but my pronouns were she, her, hers, because I identify as a woman and with those pronouns, it would disrupt the habit of assuming based on my name or my physical presentation or other characteristics, how I identify in the world. This is important. And I said, I want to separate them because as a person who cares about Black people, I care much more about the ability for each of us to see one another's humanity.
Yes.
And to make space for us. And I do the reflexive habit of naming pronouns. Right. And that's also why I'm being clear that that's something that tends to happen in progressive white spaces. There's much more work for me that needs to be done around church hurt, talking about the way that religion, Christianity in particular, is still used to marginalize Black queer people within our own communities than it is the often reflexive, superficial way of acknowledging gender variance based on pronouns. It's important, but I hope that I'm also being clear that there's a lot more nuanced work that needs to be done within Black communities.
He's the executive director of the National Black Justice Coalition. We're talking with David Johns. And, you know, David, as I look at your bio, your history, you know, you talk about, you know, the fact that as you were a young Black boy growing up in Inglewood, you know, not seeing Black LGBTQ men, and but still that you were able to become this powerhouse man here and nationally, internationally, the support that you were able to get from your family. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I'm still a Black boy. Will always be a Black boy for me.
Yes. My
parents are both born and raised in Austin, Texas. My father is living in the house that I remember as a child visiting that belonged to my grandfather. And so much of what for me has been important is being nurtured and loved and encouraged by Black folks who I think not only understood that I had the ability to show up in the world in this way, but that this is all connected to other generations of Black people who have sacrificed so that we can live these dreams. Right? Like I have a godmother who lives in Clovis, Texas. Her husband, my godfather, who's incredibly important in my life, was a pilot. All of the Black men in my family have served in the military. He worked for the NASA space shuttle. I remember taking her to the White House floor. He reminded me of the time when Black folks couldn't walk through the front door. And it was within her lifetime. And then now here I am, her godson, walking around with passes, right? With clearance and with access, right? I'm also clear that being in that space, that literal space, is not something that I could have dreamt for myself. But I know for a fact that there are people that I have never met that have existed and made sacrifices decades before I took my first breath that did things so that I could be here. So yeah, I'm incredibly lucky in that regard. And I also know that not every Black child is nurtured and supported in ways that I have been, which is in part why I do the work that I do.
And David, that's so important because when you're looking at the mental health data and we're talking about, you know, depression and anxiety and suicidal ideation and self-harm, that it's actually been reported that the most important thing that you can do for Black queer youth in particular is provide support and love and affirmation. And those are the things that are as powerful as the counseling and all that other type of mental health, you know, things that we can also do for the child. But I also wanted just to mention in that, is the lack of queer professional mental health folks that are out there, that a lot of people that go into therapy, and Dr. Alfie spoke on this too, that they spend the majority sometimes of their sessions educating and yes. answering a bunch of ridiculous questions yes. about who they are to the therapist. And yeah. and that's in the medical community and mental health. So can you yeah. talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I will. Yeah, a couple of things come to mind. Three things in particular. One, I'm thankful for the privilege of being able to access therapy. It has been incredibly important to me, especially as I have invited people into parts of my life over the course of my professional career. And everybody needs to go to therapy, just like I know it's important for us to go to church and leave things at the altar on Sunday, at least virtually now. It's important for us to go to therapy as well. But as a Black same gender living man, I have never had a therapist who has been LGBTQIA or identified as a member of the community. And you know, it's interesting, but I spend more time ensuring that I have a therapist who is competent on issues connected to my Blackness and what it means for me to show up in the world as a Black man. More than someone who understands the nuances of also having an intersectional identity. There are definitely times, for example, when thinking about taking PrEP, which is pre-exposure prophylactics, it's a pill much like a birth control that I take every day to reduce the likelihood of becoming HIV positive. I spent a lot of time talking to my therapist about the anxiety that I have taking this pill as a Black man, because I don't trust the federal government. I definitely don't trust the medical industrial complex. I think often about the Tuskegee experiment.
Yes.
And there's very little that we know about a lot of these drugs, in part because Black people don't participate in the trials in mass, so that we know what happens to our bodies in particular. I had a Black female physician who was very clear about all of that history as well, and had lots of questions and concerns, quite frankly, about me taking this pill. And I had to balance that with the reality that the CDC said years ago that one in every two Black gay men are same gender loving men. They use the term men who have sex with men, which is problematic because it includes trans women who are not men who have sex with men. But they said that one in every two of us, if things continue as they have, would become HIV positive over the course of our lifetime. And so that was a point in my professional experience with therapy, that those two things, which are sometimes siloed in conversation, Blackness and sexual identity, were very much intertwined. And I spent much more time than I otherwise would have liked to helping my therapist develop competency around not only my experience as a Black same gender loving man, but my experience as a Black same gender loving man in a country where we are predisposed to HIV, not because we engage in riskier sexual behavior, but because of white supremacy and anti-Blackness, to keep it short. And so I am often challenged when recommending therapy to Black LGBTQIA SGL people, because I know that that is an additional form of labor that we often have to sign up for and never get credit for. Which is something that is true for Black people in mass, and it is a problem that we need to address, including now, given that all of these issues are being exacerbated by the current crisis.
David Johns, I tell you what, man, this has been just an eye-opener for, I'm sure, everyone, but particularly myself and Makiba, to be able to talk to you. You are just a game changer as it relates to how we process things in our community. Love the fact that, you know, what you're trying to do, again, make our communities do better for the sake of our Black children, which then means we're going to be better all the way around. How can people find you, Dave, and get more information about your organizations and your campaigns that you're working on?
Yeah, I appreciate that. Also, point of privilege, just want to say thank you both, Makiba and Vince, for making space for this. We don't have conversations about Black mental health nearly as often as we should, and so I applaud you all for ensuring that we do a better job of that, and in order to share space with you all. People can follow up, would love to be a resource. I'm at Mr. David Johns, just MR. My name, David, D-A-V-I-D, Johns, J-O-H-N-S, across all digital platforms. Our website is NBJC, the National Black Justice Coalition.org. And if I could want to highlight three resources that I hope will be helpful to people.
Please do.
And so one is there's a it blanks and then look it up while it comes to me. So there's a podcast called In Those Genes by a really dope sister. She's a geneticist that I think is really helpful for a lot of Black people that are struggling with misinformation around coronavirus. And we're going to be doing some work together across our platforms, but encourage everybody to look up In Those Genes as a podcast available on a number of platforms. There's also a really brilliant young scholar, Kia Darling Hammett. For anyone who's an education wonk, she's a daughter of Linda Darling Hammett. She's an actual game changer with regard to both policy and practice and how we approach changing systems to be more responsive to that which we've discussed and the needs of Black kids and all their diverse beauty. But Kia Darling Hammett has used her research at Stanford to talk about thriving. And in particular, what she acknowledges is that often in therapy, the clinical settings, the goal for Black people, for queer people, for Black queer people is to be just enough, right? What coping skills can you adopt? What strategies can you employ so that you can get by at work, at church, at home, in these spaces where you otherwise can't be? And to the points that I made earlier around the importance of simply being in the way that white supremacy robs us of that, Kia's research talks about thriving. And the components that are necessary for Black queer people specifically for the purposes of her research, but for Black people more generally for the audience to really not only show up and not only show up, but to show out. And so I encourage everybody to look up Kia and her research. And on our website, you'll find more about that because we're working together on our Thriving Summit series. And then I know that there are a lot of people who literally cannot afford a therapy. It's a privilege. Again, one of the ways that capitalism works to our detriment. Talkspace is something that I'm utilizing because I can't date therapists in the way that I require to find a meaningful relationship with a therapist. And so I encourage everybody to think about resources like that for any Black LGBTQ youth that are listening or are digest this at some point. The Trevor Project has a hotline that I encourage you to use if you are in a moment of crisis or need a resource. And then there are a number of podcasts that we've actually shared at NBJC on the Move in our Instagram page and as well on my Instagram page that are free. And they talk about Blackness and therapy in nature. There's one specifically about Black girl therapy that I encourage everybody to go look up and enjoy.
Wow. Thank you so much, David J. Johns, the executive director, again, the NBJC, the National Black Justice Coalition. And we'll be looking to hear a lot more from you, David. And God bless, man. Keep up the great work that you're doing. Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you, David.
Thank you both. I appreciate it.
All right. That's what it is. It's Black Middle Matters. Take care.